Hello and welcome to the I Can Do podcast with Benjamin Lee. We're here to talk about tips and strategies to have an I Can Do mindset. Life is what you put into it. Get the most you can. Here's your host, Benjamin Lee.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of I Can Do. I am Benjamin Lee. Thank you so much for listening to this episode and supporting the podcast. Really excited today about this conversation that I'm going to share with you with Brett Magpyeong. I had the opportunity to talk to him. Brett is the founder of Rudius Strategies Group. He is the author of the Amazon best-selling book, The Delta Theorem. You want to go out and pick that up today. It is an innovative framework for being fully alive and truly wealthy. You're going to learn a lot more about this idea of the Delta Theorem and what it exactly means. Before we dive into the interview, let me share a couple of thoughts with you concerning Brett and some of the work that he's been able to do. Brett has dedicated his entire professional career coaching and advising executives, entrepreneurs, athletes, entertainers, mostly as a C-suite executive for several private firms, families, and partnerships. Many of the individuals and families he has advised have been recognized on the Forbes 400 and Fortune 500 listings. He has worked with companies like Walt Disney, Universal, Paramount, Network, the NFL, and the Major League Soccer. His why is to inspire aliveness by helping his clients to live out their purpose and to increase performance at an elite level faster than they could ever have imagined with respect to his clients. You will definitely hear his passion, his desire to help people. It was a great pleasure for me to be able to talk to Brett, to get to know him a little bit more. We're going to talk about a variety of things, how he got on this journey of writing this book, exactly what the Delta Theorem is, why coaching is important, what it is, the importance and value of effort, viewing failure in a different way. So many times we look at failure the wrong way, and so much more. So I hope that you'll get a sheet of paper out, a pencil or a pen, or listen to this episode a couple of times. You will be benefited from it, and seeing the and hearing the passion of Brett will definitely inspire you to want to continue to grow in every area of your life. All right, here we go. Brett, welcome to the show.
So great to be here. Thanks, Ben, for having me on. I really enjoy our time together here.
Yeah, you are welcome. Thank you so much for being on the show. And it's been great being able to get to know you. I know we talked a little bit last month about the podcast itself, and really excited to get your thoughts on a lot of things. So first, I just want to say congratulations on your new book, The Delta Theorem, if I'm pronouncing it correctly.
You are, yes.
Which is now available on Amazon. I was just telling you a moment ago, I'm reading it, not all the way through, but fantastic work with that. How was that experience, or what did it feel like when it finally was now available on Amazon for you?
Yeah, it was a fewfold. One, you know, the ability to get it out there and off the shoulders was a good thing. Interestingly enough, if I can share this story about it,
please.
Probably 5 or 6 years ago, I wrote on this card to write a book as a goal, to write a book by the age of 60. And so I put that little card, as sometimes they tell you, like, stick your goal in front of you on the mirror or something like that. Mm-hmm. I actually have this hot box. I call it my boardroom. Okay. It's an individual sauna. And at the end of my workouts, I go sit in this sauna, and I happen to talk to the chairman of my board, and talk about, you know, prayer through things and looking at goals and what have you. And I posted this goal right in front of me in there, and I would look at it, you know, and it was just a reminder, obviously, to get it done and what have you. Literally, Ben, I'm not kidding you. On February 28th, I think I got the publisher's proof of my book back, And on March 10th of this year, I turned 60. Wow. So that was really kind of it was a lot of things associated with that. Just, you know, not only the effort that I put into it, but just the thought process around, you know, putting out there in my boardroom every day and kind of like looking at it and getting that done. So yeah, it feels good. It feels very good.
Well, two things. One, I want a sauna as well. All right. I definitely want to get one of those one day, but the heat therapy too. I love hearing that story, and that fits perfectly with some of the things we're going to be talking about today, because that's not an accident. And I think sometimes people can have goals and they can have these visions and can be passionate about a lot of things. But as you talk about in your book, there has to be effort behind it. And for that to happen, that certainly does not sound just like coincidence of, okay, it's year six or year five. You know, you have to put a lot of energy and effort. So I definitely love for you to share some more insights with that. I want to go back and I want to get started with when you talk about in the book, when you're on the bus, and how things begin to change when you're on the bus, because it feels like that's what has gotten you to this point with the book and with this mathematical equation for life and being more alive. Can you tell the audience a little bit about that bus ride, why that bus ride had such an impact on you?
Yeah. You know, I start the introduction to the entire book about this bus ride, right? And a little bit of backstory beforehand is that I spent 35 years in the wealth management space. And in that space, I served a very kind of a small niche of people. And that was the, I'm going to call them less than one percenters. These are folks that have uber wealth. And I was serving them from the standpoint of, you know, helping them obviously with their investments, helping them with purchasing of assets, structures, all kinds of different things that had to do with it. And what I found was that oftentimes, more times than not, I had folks that were asking me questions about not the money. They were asking questions about what was the money going to do to their kids? Mm-hmm. Or how come they felt like they didn't have enough time on their hands? Or, you know, these very interesting questions that you would think that somebody has that kind of wealth, like they don't have problems. Not true. Okay. And there was an understanding that I gained and an awareness that I think that they felt like there was something more, right? And it wasn't about the financial side of stuff.
Yeah.
I had been able to fly, let's say, on some of their private jets. And this particular situation is I was working in San Francisco, mm-hmm. and I flew home for the weekend because my family is down here in LA. Mm-hmm. And I decided, because in San Francisco, everyone takes the bus, I took the bus. Mm-hmm. I'd try the bus in LA. You don't take the bus in LA, okay?
Right.
But I got on the bus. It was a Friday night, and there was not many people on that bus. And what happened to me is I had this feeling like, wow, I've got clients that are feeling that there's more. And I'm looking at this bus ride and I'm thinking, wow, there's people on here that really do feel like they don't have much and there's more. And it just spawned on me this idea that this journey that we're on is a much larger story than maybe we feel like we're living. Mm-hmm. It also brought me back to this time, and I say this and tell this story in the book, when I was traveling through Europe as a backpacker before I started my career. I graduated college and had a little bit of time, so I went to Europe. I had a backpack, a sleeping bag, a hitchhiker's thumb, and a Eurail pass. And then one of the things that happened was I landed in Florence, Italy, and I went into a museum there. I'm not a big museum guy, but I went into the museum there, and there was the statues of Michelangelo that were there, many works. In this one hallway, there were these works that were unfinished blocks of marble. They're called the prisoners. because what it is there's like an arm that's coming out of this block of marble, but that's it, or a torso. And it looks like there's people trapped.
Yeah.
Literally. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the end of this hallway and there's the statue of the David. And I got to tell you, the statue of the David is one of the most amazing things you'll ever lay your eyes on. It's massive. It's beautiful. It's perfect. It doesn't matter if you're an art person or not. Mm-hmm. It takes your breath away. Mm-hmm. And on that bus ride, I remembered thinking to myself, wow, that's like our life.
Yeah.
We're these blocks of marble that are waiting to come alive.
Yeah.
And we might think that there are things like money or, you know, status or stature that are going to bring life. But I experienced with my clients that it didn't. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, wow, there's got to be some tools here available to us mm-hmm. to chisel away at the raw material that is us to allow our splendor, you know, our being alive to happen like the David was. And so that was the story of the bus ride. Nice. Didn't expect that to be the case. It was really two worlds clashing into each other, frankly. And the result of it was the Delta theorem.
Yeah. And so it's interesting too, a couple of thoughts, you know, when we put ourselves in different environments, it's interesting how that can open up our eyes to see life, you know, in a different way. And I'm wondering too, if sometimes we just don't do that enough, where we get so stuck in our routine. I know you kind of talked about routine with dropping your daughter off at school and then something changes or something is different that day, but we have these patterns of, you know, kind of how we live and things like that. And so something that will shake us up to see, oh, wait a second, there is something else. So how fast did you move? Like when you had that, I don't know, feeling or intuition, people have this at times, and then sometimes we can kind of push it aside or push it down. How fast was it for you? So you're already working with these uber rich, you know, what was that next step? Like how fast before you started implementing some of these ideas or passions that you had?
Yeah. You know, look, I had always worked with my clients around different things than just the financial. I mean, that was where I found that the best relationship as a wealth advisor actually came into play. Okay. So I had already been working with them around, well, let's talk about what the money is going to do to your kids, or let's talk about, you know, transcendent legacy for yourself and that kind of thing. They didn't come to me as a therapist or anything like that. I wasn't a wealth therapist. I just chose to be in relationship with them. So, you know, that was already going on. It was really more how I got to writing the book was thinking about all the different things that I have read that were, in a sense, books in isolation. Like I may have read a book on failure, but it didn't touch on purpose necessarily. Or I may have read about purpose and it didn't necessarily touch on effort. So it was literally, you know, me running across things and saying, oh gosh, that looks like something I would love to, you know, kind of like tie together, that is where things started to happen. I would say that bus ride was probably 5 years before I wrote that note in the box.
Yeah.
Literally. Okay. And it took me, you know, 5 years of thinking about, wow, that's interesting. Oh, this is kind of interesting. And it was when I started to come together that I said, okay, I really want to write a book about this, but I'm working. I've got a lot going on. I know I'm not going to be able to do it. So let's make this a goal and let's set a time frame by which, you know, I'll try to get this done by. And that's where, you know, things kind of came together for me.
Awesome. All right. So let's talk about the Delta theorem. I love the title here. You tell me if I have this correct. Alpha over P cubed by E, F squared equals Delta.
You are brilliant, my friend. You are brilliant. You are brilliant. That is exactly the Delta theorem.
What is the Delta theorem? Break this down for us.
So yes, it is a framework that is in the form of this math equation, alpha over P cubed by E F squared equals Delta.
Yeah.
But this is what it means.
Okay.
Alpha is the first letter in the Greek alphabet. Mm-hmm. And in this framework, what it represents is a person's purpose, their reason for being, their powerful why. It sits on a foundation of P cubed, which represents a person's priorities, their principles, and their passion. You know, Ben, what I found in working with clients or doing some coaching that I've been doing is that oftentimes I would ask this pretty pivotal question. Tell me what your purpose is. And I would say that more times than not, I would get the response that looked like this. I have no idea.
Really?
I have no idea. And by the way, it's such a big question.
Yeah.
That if I give you an answer, does that mean it will never change? Like I can't have a different purpose somewhere down the road. So it's overwhelming oftentimes for a person to just kind of say, this is what my purpose is. But if I ask them, all right, let's start with your priorities. Tell me what your priorities are.
Yeah.
You mentioned something about, you know, this ride to school with my daughter that I write about. Mm-hmm. And in there, I talk about her priorities were friendship. Mm-hmm. And my priority was her. Mm-hmm. You'll have to read the book to like, you know what that story is all about. But priorities are things that are the most important for us. And they're usually tied with life events, quite frankly. If I'm married, it's a different priority than if I'm single. Or if I have a career, that might be a different priority than I'm in school. So priorities change over time, right? Principles are things that don't change. They're the non-negotiables in our life. If I say to you, Ben, tell me what you stand for, you will likely be able to, I know you, you will likely be able to say, this is what I stand for. And they come from various places. They could be, you know, religious backgrounds. They could be things that parents handed down to them. They could be things that just resonate with us. One of my principles is, comes from a Justin Timberlake song. And it says this. Sometimes the greatest way to say something is to say nothing at all.
Oh, yeah. I know that.
I love that song. Yeah. I love that. Sometimes the greatest way to say something is to say nothing at all.
Why is that so influential to you?
Because there have been way too many times when I've spoken too quickly that I didn't pause and think about what I was hearing. I was just like, You, me, let me say something, you know? And so sometimes the greatest way to say something is to say nothing at all. I mean, think about, you know, if you've been in situations where somebody's lost a loved one, mm-hmm. and you want to say something to them, you want to so badly.
Yeah.
And yet I think it was C.S. Lewis who said that he didn't want to be alone, but he didn't want to have to answer any questions when he lost somebody. It's like, I just want you to be in my presence, but you don't need to say anything to me right there. That I love. I love that kind of like sensitivity. So for me, that's an important principle. You know, I don't always live that by that. Sometimes I still stick my foot in my mouth, but it's a principle. Regardless, point is principles are things that we stand for. And then the final part of the P is passion. And passion is, if I ask you, Ben, tell me what, you know, makes you come alive. Like you just, in that situation, you just know you need to step in, or you need to do this, or you need to encourage, or whatever it is that makes you really come alive. That's, you know, a passion. If you look at those three things, those three P's, and I had this kind of put together for me that I then looked at them as Olympic rings where they overlap with each other. And in the middle, where those three rings intersect, is more times than not where a person's purpose is.
So when you're coaching then, so are you starting with purpose, or are you starting more with these three P's?
I'm starting with those three P's. Okay. And then, yes, exactly. I'm starting with those three P's. And then from there, a person's purpose it starts to reveal itself. I mean, coaching is about creating aha moments. It's not about telling somebody what to do, right? It's mm-hmm. it's like you tell me what it is in your life. And so they can look at their priorities. They can say what their principles are. They tell me what their passion is. And then I ask them, well, what do you think your purpose is inside of these kinds of things? It starts to reveal itself. And if they say something that is for my ears and not for their heart, usually it will be in violation or incongruent with one of those three P's. And I can just say that to them, like, that doesn't sound like that's, you know, tying in with your principles, or your priorities are a little bit different right now than what that is. And so, you know, that's the process by which we go about it. So, yeah.
Nice.
All that though, Ben, is all theoretical. I mean, it's just theory. Purpose, yeah. These kinds of things are a little bit soft. They're a theory. Nothing happens without effort.
Yeah.
And that's the buy. That's the multiply. So it's alpha over P, or alpha over PQ by E, and E is effort. Mm-hmm. What are we going to do about this kind of thing? You know, in the coaching environment, that's where you set things up. Like, okay, what kind of training plans can we have around these kinds of things? And what are some things that you want to do in order to activate, you know, your purpose and that kind of thing? And then finally, the last element on this side of the equation is F, and F in the Delta Theorem is failure.
Yeah.
Usually failure is looked at as a negative. I always looked at it as a negative, mm-hmm. but this is the only place math comes up. When you square a negative in math, it becomes a positive. I don't understand it.
Yeah.
-2 × -2 = +4. It doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever, but that's the way that it is. Right. And so the concept in the Delta Theorem is it's the learning that we gain from failure. So purpose that sits on a foundation of my priorities, my principles, my passion, supercharged by effort and the learning that comes from failure, all that equals Delta. And Delta in the Greek alphabet is the symbol for change. It's the symbol for making a difference. It's a symbol for impact. So the whole concept behind the book, and really in my life and in clients, is I want to make a difference. Mm-hmm. I want to have an impact. I don't want to be stuck on the freeway thinking like, really, this is it? Traffic? I'm just going to work? Like, yeah, my story feels really large, but I know there's something much larger that I'm caught up in. How can I tap into that? How can I come alive like that David, you know, statue? Well, this is a chisel. This is a chisel that I'm providing to people to say, why don't you go through this framework and this process? And maybe you'll put yourself in the best position or a great position to be able to make change. No guarantees. I mean, you don't go through this and like, oh, well, now I make a difference. No, you got to live life, right? I mean, it's life is lived in color. Frameworks are black and white. You know, this is just the ability for somebody to walk through, you know, and put themselves in a good position.
So anyone can use this theorem. And also that's important what you just said too. It's not just going to happen overnight. The E sounds really important with the effort. Do you find that the effort, when you're working with clients or those who are listening, would it be P, the priorities, principle, passion, or where do you find it most challenging for people? My first thought is with the effort, because people have knowledge, people have exercises, templates, PDFs, but that effort has to be put behind it. Where do you see, or what's your experience where it's most challenging?
Yeah. It's challenging, as I said, on one part of it, on the purpose side of it, because it's hard for people to commit to that. I mean, not everyone. I mean, you know, there are people that know what their purpose is. Okay. But they may not activate it. So for sure, the hardest part is in the effort. I think that I was, you know, unfortunately, I was given this statistic that something like 2% of the population will like actually follow through on this book, Brett. You know, I mean, yeah. Like that's just the reality of it. 2% yeah. of the people that are there. And I think that is true. So, you know, effort is for sure the hardest thing to be able to do it. And, you know, I talk about this notion of crawl, walk, run. See, one of the reasons why effort, I think, is so challenging is that we all start to run. I mean, we think that like, okay, I'm going to write a book and my purpose is to inspire aliveness. By the way, that's me. I want to inspire people to come alive. That's what I feel like my purpose is. So I say to myself, well, the best way to do that is to write a book. And the best way to then do it beyond that is to do a TED talk. Guess what? That is like, that's running. That's sprinting. How about if I just read a blog post, highlight some of the things that caught my attention and file it away in a digital file so that I can go back to it when I go to sit down and write an outline of like, okay, that was a good idea in terms of like what the idea was here. That's crawling. Mm-hmm. Like we run too much and then we fail. And yes, we learn from our failure, but sometimes the learning we learn is I'll never do that again, which is the wrong learning.
Do you think people are running? I'm guilty of this as well. And I think about a passage in the book of Exodus with the Israelites when God was going to give them the promised land. He said, I'm not going to give it to you in a year. And I love what he said next. I think it's Exodus 23. He said, little by little, I will give you this land. And that sounds like the crawl, right? You got to crawl, then you got to walk, and then you got to run.
Right.
What's getting in the way or what's causing us to run? Is it the comparison game? Is it social media? You correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know. I don't think you're on Instagram or Facebook. Is it, you know, just this urgency of I have to just make it to the top? Is it insecurity? What do you see as why people want to just instantly run?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously very complicated. I think that there's a number of factors that come into play. Delayed gratification has been around forever, right? I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen that study they did with the marshmallow study. Have you ever seen that with kids?
Yes, oh my God.
It is fantastic, right? I mean, these kids are told you're going to get, you know, two marshmallows if you could just hang out and not eat this one that's in front of you. And the video of it is just precious, right? What the kids are trying to do to like keep themselves from eating that marshmallow. And it's delayed gratification, right? I mean, in a environment that we live in today, where not only do I expect the light to go on when I flip the switch, but I expect my computer to boot up quicker than you could imagine. And if it doesn't, I'm impatient.
Yeah.
We are bombarded with the fight against delayed gratification, you know? And so I think that that's hard, you know, that we live in that environment. I think we see situations that look like it was really easy. I mean, some of the my clients that were very young and had, you know, tremendous amounts of wealth, you know, that's what my daughter is seeing. You know, she's thinking like, wow, they're in their 20s and they have this kind of wealth. You know, that shouldn't I be able to have that too? It's not that easy, right? It's just not that easy. There's only one Michael Jordan, but you know, that didn't think that I wasn't going to be a professional basketball player that was, you know, when I was growing up and that kind of stuff. It's just not that easy. And we're seeing it right in our face all the time and it looks easy. And so I think that the work that it requires to get there is in a sense overlooked. And what I mean by the work, I'm talking about the crawl, like really the crawl work. And that's the hardest, you know, part of it is to just get started. I would sit down at my computer, I'd look at a blank page, and I'm like, oh my gosh, what's the first word that I write? You know, hard. But then once I started to get this flow, and I talk about flow in the book, like, you know, the concept of flow, it's really important. Like we get in that zone. And so effort actually can become easy if we can put ourselves in this position where we get started and the flow can come. So yeah, but it's complicated. Very complicated. Yeah.
No, absolutely. I love those answers there with delayed gratification. I can definitely relate to that. Especially on the financial side too. I've been thinking more about that as well. I definitely can see certain strengths that I've had, certain areas of improvement growing up. And I want to talk a little bit about, you know, how you got to this point. I know you mentioned in the book that, I think you said you came from like a more of a working class, you know.
I did.
So my dad was not around when I was growing up, and, you know, my mom was on food stamps. She worked hard. We used to clean houses with her. And as I think back to that, I often think about, you know, there was a lot of scarcity. And yeah. I can remember little things, just whether, you know, eating something in the car from the store. And I was that kid, I'd eat the marshmallow. I'm not waiting for the second marshmallow. I'm eating the first marshmallow. But then I'm upset with my cousin because he's delaying the gratification and he has his honey bun when we get back to the house. I've already eaten mine. So it is curious, just kind of like an onion, right? Peeling back the layers to kind of see, all right, why do I act this way? Or why do I feel this way? Or yeah, just wait 20 or 30 more minutes for that second marshmallow. Walk us through, where did this effort on your part, you know, I'm looking at some of your credentials. You've worked with Walt Disney and Universal and Paramount and NFL and the MLS. Where did this effort for you, how was that developed? Can you share some thoughts with that to us?
Yeah, sure. So let me first start off to something I said previously, which was, look, there is no formula to life, right? I mean, life has to be lived. So there is no formula. What my situation was, you know, different than anyone else's. That seems to be an obvious thing. For me, I found that my modest kind of like upbringing was a tremendous asset to me as I found myself in these various circumstances that I did. And why? Because I accepted it as like identity. I knew who I was. I wasn't trying to be somebody else. And that was very refreshing, I think, in the environments that I found myself in. Now, not always. And, you know, listen, I worked at some very, very proper places. And, you know, it wasn't like I'm going in there and was vulgar or anything, you know, inside of that kind of thing. It was more that I just felt like I knew who I was. And that, I think, is a really critical thing to do. Understanding your identity, right? I mean, I think about you referenced, you know, Exodus. I think about the temptations that Christ went through. Each one of those was a question about identity. Are you really? Are, you know, like, these are all attacks on identity. Like, know who you are. And for me, having grown up in modest circumstances, I knew who I was, you know, inside of that. And I say that with all humility. It was something that was good for me. It wasn't like this motivator, like, oh, I'm going to, like, you know, make abundant money because I didn't have money in that. No, it just, I knew that, like, this is who I was and this is the environment that I'm in. And there could be situations where I can bring that to the table. I love to tell this story. This is actually quite funny. when I was in college and I went to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo and graduated, in it with a business degree, accounting concentration. And, you know, I'd say that the first test I ever failed as a kid was name the four seasons. And I said football, basketball, baseball, and hockey. Because in my household, winter, spring, summer, fall were not seasons.
Yeah.
It was awesome. Football, baseball, you know, basketball, and hockey.
Great. I love that.
So I go through these on-campus interviews, Ben.
Yeah.
And, Price Waterhouse was one of the large accounting firms, and they come on campus. And, you know, at the time there were eight large accounting firms, yeah, and they were called the Big Eight. So I sit down with this recruiter and I'm sitting down and she says to me, you know, tell me what you know about the Big Eight. And I looked at her and I said, well, it's a football conference in the Midwest somewhere, I think. And she looks at me, with this look of like, he's either really messing with me or, you know, I don't like this guy, or
he actually really doesn't know. And when she saw the look on my face that recognized her look, and she's like, this guy really doesn't know, right?
Oh, that's so
and,
good.
And yet this guy is comfortable enough to be, you know, honest with me in this interview. Yes. I actually think that it probably contributed to me getting the job, frankly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think it did, you know? And so when I talk about identity and I talk about knowing who you are, that's who I was, right? I mean, that's who I was. I was that. Now, I knew my technical stuff in the workplace. I did my job extraordinarily well. I did the work. I studied. I had to learn how to be a wealth manager. I had to, I couldn't just like fake it in terms of like structures and, you know, these complex situations. I had to know that stuff, but I knew my identity and what I was bringing to the table, you know, inside that. So, you know, that's what my upbringing kind of helped me with.
Nice. Nice. Yeah. Thinking about the book a little bit more, do you remember what books that really helped contribute to getting you to the point of the Delta Theorem? I know you mentioned a couple of books, you know, you would read this, but it was missing something. Were there certain, you know, pillars with respect to books that kind of put you on this path?
Yes. I'm a voracious reader, just so you know, as well. I actually am a voracious listener these days. You know, I listen on Audible and stuff, and then I'll actually get the book and listen to it again and highlight and that kind of stuff. That's just my process. But, you know, some of the more pivotal books for me, included Viktor Frankl wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. Just a tremendous book. You know, Viktor Frankl was a Holocaust, survivor. And he writes about, you know, his experience in the camps and what he learned about man's search for meaning and that why having purpose and meaning is so powerful. It was for him to get through what he went through, and that was very pivotal for me. I've read probably every book that John Eldridge has written, Wild at Heart, Journey of Desire, Sacred Romance, you name it. He is just an amazing writer. And there are many thought processes that were very influential for me in what he had. One was the larger story. You know, I talk about the larger story. John Eldridge wrote about the larger story, that we inside of ourselves know that there's something much larger going on that we're caught up in. And yet our lives feel large, but they're kind of small. You know, our lives are, I'm married, I have a daughter, I have a home and cars and a career and that kind of stuff. And that's a very large story. But then on the 405 freeway here in Los Angeles, when I'm stuck in traffic and I just kind of sigh, like, ah, there's got to be something more. That's what John Eldridge tapped into. This notion of, no, there's a much larger story that's going on. And we all play a part in that particular thing. Now, I also talk in the book about this thing called the butterfly effect, because, you know, too often we can think about, oh, you know, make a difference. It's got to be huge. No, it doesn't. Why?
Cup of cold water.
Yeah. Cup of cold water. Right. Exactly. I mean, I go on a workout every morning with my dog, except for Saturdays, because I have coffee with my buddies. Mm-hmm. And if I run across a nail on the side of the road, I pick it up.
Yeah.
And the reason I pick it up is that I think to myself, this nail could puncture somebody's tire.
Yep.
And it could be somebody that's on their way to the hospital.
Yeah.
And now life has just changed. Or it could be somebody that's just, when they get a flat tire, they're going to be angry.
Yeah.
Like we all are. And their life is going to change. And so I can just go down, pick up that nail, mm-hmm. and it's a butterfly effect. I don't know what impact it's going to have, but it could have a tremendous impact. So small things, a little cup of water, you know, is really, really important inside of that. So, you know, John Eldridge tapping on that was huge. John Maxwell, I think, wrote a great book on failure. You know, that was very pivotal for me when I was reading about failure. There's so many books on effort that you could, you know, there's just tons of books on effort. And so, you know, but those are some of the ones that had a great influence in my mindset.
That's awesome. I love books too. So thank you for sharing that. And I think I have two or three of John Eldridge's books as well. Wild at Heart, you had mentioned. I believe he has like a workbook as well. And I did that. A friend of mine told me about him a few years ago. So that's how I learned about him. Really enjoy John Maxwell as well. I've had a lot of his books throughout the years. Just thinking about John Eldridge too. I know he talks a lot about movies and lessons you can learn from movies. And I know you're a big movie fan and have different stories in your book as well about movies. So I think that's pretty cool. Talk to us a little bit about, another question. I'm just curious, how many books do you have like a goal with how many you're trying to read per month? I've started using Audible as well. I listened to The Stress Prescription. Great book. Are you reading a book a week? What does that look like for you? I'm always curious with that.
Yeah, I don't have a goal like that. Okay. Like, hey, I'm going to get through that. In fact, I'm a little bit concerned at times that, like, I don't have the comprehension because I'm going through books, you know, too quickly or what have you. So I don't have a goal, but what I end up finding is that my ritual, I call it a ritual in the book. I don't call it habits. Habits are things that are great for effort, right? Because they are effortless effort. That's the definition, right? But habits don't just happen. Like, they get developed, and they get developed, I say, through a ritual. And I call it a ritual because ritual has this feeling of sacredness. You know, like, if I miss my morning ritual, which includes taking my dog out and going into my hot box and, you know, contemplating, meditation, number of different things that are associated with it, it's almost like my day is like not going to go well. That's how it feels.
Yeah.
So back to your question, my morning ritual includes, you know, a four mile either run or ruck with a heavy backpack with my dog. That's a good 45 minutes to an hour and 10 minutes that I have that I can stack an activity. And what I stack is the physical with the mental. I'm listening to books, right? And so if a book is a 5-hour Audible book, I'm getting through that book in 1 week's time. Mm-hmm. If it's a 24-hour one, you know, it's taken me 5 weeks to get through that, you know, particular book. So it really just depends on that front. Let me tell you a thing that I did learn that's been very helpful for me. I got the app called Libby, which is a library, basically, you know, app. And you can check out books, right? So what I do is I will get, because I'm an Audible subscriber, I'll get a book and then I'll listen to it, usually at faster speed than just 1x, not tremendously fast, but a little faster speed. Then I'll check the book out on Libby and then I'll listen to it again at a faster speed and I'll go through it on Libby and I'll highlight things out of Libby because it's, you know, Kindle, basically a Kindle book. And then I can email those notes that I highlighted to myself. And I end up with, you know, this ability to have all these notes from books that, you know, I have that I can reference back to. And it certainly helped in research for the book itself, but it's also just for me. I mean, I've got books that I read and highlighted, and I didn't include those concepts in the book. I just loved it, you know, that it was such an important book. So, you know, that's my process of what I go about doing it. But look, I don't want to overlook the thing of, like, it can also be very not deep and wide. You know, there's some people that say, just pick out two authors and just, you know, go with them through all of it and read their books over and over and over. And I see that there can be value in that. Listen, anybody wants to do that with the Delta Theorem?
Please do.
Please do. You can read it multiple times on it.
You get it on Kindle, you get paperback.
It's not on Audible yet, but you know.
Yeah, I was going to ask, are you going to do an Audible for the book?
I don't know. I don't know. I was encouraged to do it. I haven't, you know, kind of gone that route at this point.
That would be sweet. So I know we're kind of coming up here on time. Brett, how do you define wealth? You've worked with wealthy people. How do you define what true wealth is?
Yeah, I've come to discover that true wealth is a mixture of what I would say five different elements of wealth. Certainly financial. I mean, no doubt about it. Financial wealth, you can't say that finances is not wealth, but there's relational wealth.
Yep.
Right now, Ben, you and I are building relational wealth. That's how I feel.
Yep.
And we built it, you know, even prior to this. That's mm-hmm. an important component of wealth. Mm-hmm. I feel wealthy as a result of our conversations. Mm-hmm. There's physical wealth. That's just health. You know, if I'm not feeling well, I'm not feeling wealthy. I don't care what the size of my bank account is or how many relationships I have. If I'm not physically well of my own doing, potentially or not, then that's a component of wealth. There's mental and spiritual wealth. I'll combine those into, you know, kind of one where peace of mind, just on your own, knowing your identity, you know, having clear mind and feeling good about that. That's wealth. And then there's a wealth of time. You know, I mean, it's the only resource that is wasting away. And, you know, if you don't have any time, you don't feel that wealthy. You feel harried. You feel those kinds of things. So, you know, what I say that wealth is really the combination of those five. And I can't tell you it's 20% each or anything like that. It doesn't really work that way. All I do know is that I've experienced way too much where people have only defined wealth as the financial, and it's not. And they would be the first ones to tell me that, even though they wouldn't articulate it in that way. So it's really a combination of all those things and figuring out a way how to tap into those, you know, particular things in a way that has it be balanced, you know, and not one over the other. I mean, you know, somebody could be physically wealthy. They could be a total specimen. And a mental just like not well, right? And not making their relationships well around them, you know? So yeah, that's how I would define true wealth.
Thank you for that. That's really good. Yeah, I agree with that as well. And I know you talk a lot about, or you talk somewhat about priorities versus prioritizing.
That's right.
If this is how we're going to define wealth, this becomes really important. So I use the Michael Hyatt planner. I've been using that planner for a few years, but there's something important about putting these kinds of elements, whatever planner we use or however we're managing our time and things like that. So the first things really stay the first things. And so I really appreciated that part in the book as well, how these elements of wealth should drive the schedule, right? And not get kicked off. So
that's right. That's right. Yeah. I mean, my framework inside of it is it looks like this. I believe that it starts with people coming alive. Like there's a statement by a quote from Howard Thurman, who was in the civil rights. Also, I think he was a pastor and an academic and stuff. And he said this: don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and do that. Because what the world needs is more people who are fully alive. And I just found that to be really true, right? Like too often we're asking, what does the world need? And I'll do that, as opposed to what makes me really come alive? And let me figure out what that is. Because when people are around people that are fully alive, they come alive as a result of that too. All right. So it starts there. Come alive. When we come alive, guess what? We make a difference.
That's right.
And when we make a difference, we create value. And when we create value is when true wealth starts to happen. I mean, and that's true for just financial too. You create financial wealth when you create value, right? Yeah. And you create value when you're a difference maker. I endeavored to be a difference maker in my career. Mm-hmm. And then that created value and it provided for a level of wealth for me. Mm-hmm. But it started with identity. It started with coming alive, like we talked about earlier on this. So, you know, that's the kind of thing of what I'm when I say that my purpose is to inspire aliveness. Mm-hmm. It's because I want people to get on that part of this and just figure that out so that they can really get down this path of what, you know, true wealth is really all about.
As I listened to you speak, I was going to ask you another question, but I was like, well, I think I may already have the answer to it. You know, as you define wealth in this way, contentment came into my mind. So yes. I know there's a lot from a biblical standpoint, but if, you know, if money is the only way that we define wealth or even define who we are,
right,
we're always going to feel, there's always going to be something lacking. You know, people are trying to get more money, or if it gets taken away.
Yeah.
But this kind of perspective of what true wealth really is all about, I think naturally will help people to sit longer in contentment as well. Being content with what we have and who we are and where we're headed. I was going to ask you what's next, but that's one of those questions where it's like, well, what do you mean? You know, you just launched a book, you have your family, your wife, your children, your dog, you did the Murph, right? You know, so you already have a lot, but that's one of those questions too, that I'm wondering, not necessarily we need to shy away from, but being able to sit in the satisfaction of, you know, look, there's a lot that you've done this year. And so that's why now I don't want to ask that question, because there's already so much goodness that we need to appreciate. And that's probably one of the bigger challenges too. We're not appreciating all these wonderful blessings that we have. So that's where I think too, that view of wealth and how we define it becomes even more important.
I couldn't agree with you more. And thank you for those words, frankly, because it is a challenge inside of, you know, even sitting right now and saying to yourself, just saying to myself, you know, be content with this kind of stuff. Here's what it looks like now, Ben.
Okay.
It's like now that it's out on Amazon, you know, looking at rankings, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just reality of it.
It is.
I have literally, you know, said to myself, listen, look at rankings as trying to figure out how that tricks the Amazon algorithm to get this message out, because it's about the message. It's not about the ranking. It's just simply, if it's the airwaves, if it's a podcast, if it's a ranking, it's really trying to inspire people to come alive inside of this. And if there's a way that I can be a part of that, then that's great. But no doubt about it, the challenge is to say right now, like, you know, what's next? And, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
No, let's live in a little bit of contentment here. So I appreciate your words on that front.
Welcome. Yeah, you're welcome. Well, I appreciate you being on the show and taking time for this. And I want to leave you with a final thought for the audience.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that really stuck out with me, you said I was a movie guy, and I am, was from the movie Braveheart. And there's a scene in there where the Mel Gibson character he's now arrested, he's about to die. And this princess comes in and she says to him, you know, renounce and, you know, you'll live and you'll die if you don't. And he says to her, everyone dies. Not everyone really lives. I love that. Like, we all gonna die, but like really live in whatever it is, small ways. I live when I pick up that nail. I do. I think that you live when you interview me. You're really living because you're doing something that you dig. That's what I'm talking about. Everyone dies. Not everyone really lives. And when we live, could mean that we have to take risk. And when we risk, we may fail. But look it, we square up our failures, we learn from it.
Yeah.
And there's always that helps out, you know, as well. So yeah, everyone dies, not everyone really lives.
Mm. Love it. Thank you so much, Brett.
You got it.
Once again, thank you so much for tuning in to this episode. If you are in the need or are looking for more motivation in your life, feel free to check out my website,
benjaminlee.blog, where you can find hundreds of encouraging, motivational blog posts on a variety of subjects. You can find all of my books, which can also be found on amazon.com, and other podcast interviews with a variety of people. I hope this helps. Please leave me a rating and a review. I can do, and so can you. Take care, and God bless.